Some experiences feel like communication, even when no source can be identified. A presence is felt. A phrase arrives already carrying meaning. A coincidence refuses to feel accidental. There is no voice to recognize, no path to trace, and no way to know whether what happened arose within us or came from beyond us. Yet each carries the same implication. Something appears to have crossed a boundary we believed was closed. Experiences like these resist explanation. From within them, the sense that communication has occurred can feel profoundly real. How do we hold the force of an experience alongside the uncertainty of its explanation? And can we become more receptive to experiences like these? Episode 7, Communication Across the Field. I know the force of an experience like that because it happened to me. It was the eve of my birthday, on a cold and dark November night. My daughter was asleep beside me. She was 8, and with her father away for work, she often slept in my bed because she was afraid to be alone. The dog slept on the floor nearby. I woke around 2 a.m. because the heater had caught up with the cold and the bedroom had grown too warm. I lowered the thermostat to 68, used the bathroom, and left the toilet unflushed so I would not wake her. When I returned to bed, the heat cycled off. The house settled into the deep stillness of the night. That was when it began. A single note sounded, low and profoundly loud, with no discernible source. I lay completely still, frozen in fear. The vibration rang outward, slowly diminishing. A brief silence followed. Then a second note arrived. The pitch was identical, so was its force. It did not seem to travel toward me. It was suddenly present, already whole, filling the room and everything within it. Another brief silence, then a third. The sound resembled nothing I had heard before, almost like a bell fused with a string instrument. It seemed to come from beyond the window and from inside the room at once. Direction no longer made sense. It was all-encompassing, with a fullness that felt almost physical. The same short interval passed before a fourth note arrived, unchanged from the others. Something immense seemed to stand behind it. I could feel the scale of it without understanding what it was. The experience carried the force of an address, as though something had directed its attention toward me and expected me to recognize that I was being spoken to. I did not understand the message. I understood only that there was one. Then, the sound vanished as suddenly as it had appeared. A moment later, the neighborhood dogs erupted. The barking came from every direction, frantic and overlapping, as though something had moved through the night. The two dogs sleeping on my bedroom floor never stirred. My daughter was still sound asleep beside me. I did not go to the window to look out. A primitive fear took over. I closed my eyes as hard as I could, seized by the old childhood instinct that if I could not see whatever was there, then maybe it could not see me. I reached beneath the blanket for my daughter's hand. A sudden dread passed through me that one of us might be taken. I held on as though my hand could keep us together, on the same side of whatever had opened. I remained there with my eyes closed, listening for the sound to return, and afraid that it would. The rest of the night passed without another sound. In the morning, I checked the thermostat and the toilet. Both were exactly as I remembered. There was no question I had been awake when the sound rang out. I called my husband, then my parents. Somewhere in the telling, I began to cry. I could hear how impossible the story sounded. But it had happened, and I needed to tell someone because I could not make sense of it alone. They listened with kindness, but there was no way to hand them the experience itself. I could describe the sound, but I could not transfer its scale, its feeling, or the certainty that something larger than me had addressed me. The experience belonged to the part of consciousness that cannot be exported. It remained with me. For a long time, what returned most vividly was my terror. My eyes closed, my hand around my daughter's. The sense of being exposed beneath the attention of something I could neither identify nor understand. Gradually, another feeling emerged. I wanted it to happen again. I still do. I have wondered whether I was given an encounter I did not know how to meet. Whether fear ended something that might have continued. I have wondered what I would do now, more than a year and a half later, if the sound returned. I would like to believe I could remain present. That I could listen. That I might be ready to receive whatever I was unable to receive then. I cannot identify its source or explain why it seemed directed toward me. I only know that it felt otherworldly. The magnitude of what I felt exceeded the human scale so completely that every explanation available to me seemed smaller than the experience itself. So I began searching for language. Religion offered possible identities for the source. Psychology and neuroscience offered ways of understanding perception and the borderlands between waking and sleep. Other traditions spoke of spirits, messages, warnings, visitations, and contact with forms of intelligence beyond the human. Every framework illuminated something, but none could tell me what had happened in that room. Then I encountered the work of Rudolf Otto. In his 1917 book, later translated as The Idea of the Holy, the German theologian and scholar of religion set out to describe a dimension of human experience that doctrine and morality alone could not explain. Drawing from the Latin numen, a divine power or presence. He called it the numinous. For Otto, the numinous was not simply a belief in God. It was the felt encounter with something wholly other. He described its character with the phrase mysterium tremendum et fascinans, a mystery that overwhelms and draws us toward it. The mysterium is the part that exceeds comprehension. Its unknowability belongs to the experience. The tremendum is its overwhelming force, the sense of standing before a power so immense that the self contracts in response. The fascinans is the attraction that persists alongside the fear. Reading Otto, I recognized the shape of my own experience, The sound offered no explanation. Its power was inseparable from its mystery. And an encounter with the numinous can repel us in the moment and continue exerting a pull long afterward. What terrified me that night gradually became something I wanted to experience again. Otto helped me see that my search was about more than understanding what had happened. I began asking how human beings become available to experiences that exceed ordinary perception, and whether receptivity can be cultivated when the encounter itself remains beyond our control. For most of my life, art has been one of the ways I have explored questions like these. I studied fine art in college, and making and encountering art remain among the deepest sources of joy I have known. Certain works of art alter perception so completely that the familiar world becomes strange again. James Turrell has been one of my favorite artists since I first stepped inside one of his installations decades ago. I no longer remember whether I was in New York or Los Angeles. I remember the work. Turrell uses light as though it were a material substance, giving it weight and depth. Openings that seem flat become infinite. Walls dissolve. The eye loses its certainty about where an object ends and space begins. Given enough time inside one of his installations, seeing becomes less automatic. You become aware of perception as something taking place within you. His work reaches toward the sublime without telling the viewer what to believe. It changes the conditions of attention and allows the experience to become sacred on its own terms. Years later, I learned that Turrell had been raised in the Quaker tradition. That discovery illuminated something I already sensed in his work. In certain Quaker traditions, worship begins in silence without a prescribed order of service. Someone may speak if moved to do so, or the meeting may remain silent throughout. The practice leaves room for an encounter that remains personal within a shared space. Turrell once recalled asking his grandmother what they were supposed to do when they encountered the meeting house. She told him they were going inside to greet the light. That phrase contains an entire orientation toward experience, an inward posture of attention and openness to whatever may appear. Turrell's installations create a similar invitation through art. They alter the conditions of perception while leaving meaning open. That is very close to what I have been seeking, a way of becoming available without deciding in advance what must arrive. Human beings have developed many ways of approaching this threshold. People pray, meditate, fast, go on retreats, work with dreams, or use psychedelic substances, often hoping for insight, healing, or contact with something beyond the familiar self. Others explore remote viewing, asking whether information can arrive without ordinary sensory access. These practices arise from different traditions and do not necessarily lead to the same place. What they share is the possibility that ordinary waking thought is not the only form consciousness can take. I have experienced another kind of reception. Unlike the sound of the four tolls, it arrived with clear, usable content. Late one night, I was turning over a situation I deeply wanted to avoid, searching for a way through. I was tired and distressed. At some point, I directed a question outward. Then a phrase appeared in my mind. Aristotle's virtue ethics. I had no conscious relationship to the phrase. I had never studied Aristotle's ethical framework. I did not know what it contained or why it had arrived. The words were simply there.
Aristotle's virtue ethics.
I reached for my phone and searched them. What opened was an entire philosophical framework concerned with character, practical wisdom, and how to act well within the complicated circumstances of a life. It spoke directly to the situation I was facing. The phrase arrived first, and understanding followed. A few words opened into a body of knowledge that was already assembled, almost like a compressed digital file expanding with a single click. I could trace what happened afterward. I searched the phrase, read the material, and applied it. I could not trace where the phrase began. A Harvard philosopher and psychologist named William James wrote about experiences that arrive with a sense of knowledge beyond ordinary reasoning in The Varieties of Religious Experience, published in 1902. He called one of their defining characteristics a noetic quality, the sense that an experience has disclosed something true beyond what he called the discursive intellect, which is when the mind reaches understanding through sequential reasoning. William James also observed that these states can resist language, pass quickly, and leave the person feeling acted upon, as though the insight has arrived from beyond the ordinary will. His language offered a way to understand what had happened with the phrase about Aristotle. It arrived carrying recognizable content, knowledge I could investigate and use, before I understood why it had appeared. Edgar Mitchell knew this firsthand. As the lunar module pilot for Apollo 14, he brought a doctorate in aeronautics and astronautics from MIT, service as a Navy test pilot, and years of astronaut training. During the journey home in 1971, looking out at Earth against the surrounding cosmos, something occurred that would shape the rest of his life. In his own words, "Suddenly, I realized that the molecules of my body had been created or prototyped in an ancient generation of stars, along with the molecules of the spacecraft and my partners and everything else we could see, including the Earth in front of us. Suddenly, it was all very personal. Those were my molecules." He did not reason his way toward the insight. It arrived whole, carrying certainty before explanation. Mitchell described it as a kind of knowing, unlike anything in his prior experience. He would spend the rest of his life trying to understand what had happened. James was less interested in proving where an experience came from than in asking what followed from it. Did the insight deepen a life? Did it remain meaningful after the state had passed? What authority should a private revelation hold for anyone beyond the person who received it? I may have encountered Aristotle's virtue ethics before and forgotten it. That possibility remains. It does not fully account for the timing or precision of the phrase. And I may never know whether it came from memory, unconscious synthesis, or something beyond the boundaries I usually assign to mind. The uncertainty does not make the experience meaningless. It tells me where certainty ends. Prayer begins from a different place. It moves the question from information toward relationship. A person may ask for guidance and receive a feeling or sudden certainty. Another may receive nothing perceptible and still feel changed by the act itself. The response may appear in what follows, or in a new way of inhabiting the same circumstances. Prayer assumes the possibility that an address can cross the apparent separation between the human and the divine. Whether the person names what they are reaching toward as God, a larger intelligence, the source of being, or a presence without a name. People also direct that reaching toward those who have died. They speak to them, sense them in familiar rooms, or wake from dreams that carry a clarity unlike ordinary memory. Grief can alter perception, and the bonds we carry may remain psychologically vivid without requiring consciousness to survive the body. Yet some experiences leave people wondering whether relationship continues in another form. Episode 6 asked what remains when the familiar expressions of a person become inaccessible. This question reaches further. If something remains beyond the body, can it still reach us? And what would that suggest about distance, identity, and time? These possibilities can produce a hunger for experience. Once you have encountered something that seems to exceed ordinary reality, daily life no longer fits around you in quite the same way. The world continues, filled with ordinary obligations. Beneath them is the memory that reality once became much larger than the version you have been living inside. You begin looking for the opening. You listen differently. You attempt attunement, paying attention inwardly and outwardly to what arises within you and what seems to meet you from beyond the familiar boundaries of the self. You enter spaces designed for contemplation. You become curious about practices you might have once dismissed. You wonder whether the mind is always producing its own contents or whether it sometimes participates in something wider. Greater receptivity asks for equal care and interpretation. An experience may carry certainty before it offers understanding. Discernment also belongs inside receptivity. So does humility. Otto understood the numinous as a category of encounter. He did not give us a reliable method for summoning it. That may be part of its nature. We can create conditions for receptivity. We can enter silence, make art, pray, meditate, spend time in nature, or become so absorbed in an activity that the ordinary chatter of the mind begins to fall away. We can loosen some of what keeps consciousness fixed on the immediate surface of life. None of this guarantees that anything will answer. I have no practice that can bring the sound back. I only have my willingness to meet it differently. Maybe that is all preparation can offer. The ability to remain present when the familiar world gives way. To listen before deciding what an experience means. And to allow some part of it to remain unresolved. Some experiences arrive as knowledge. Others arrive as presence. Both can seem to cross the familiar limits of distance, time, identity, or form. Once communication no longer depends on recognizable channels, questions of death and time begin to gather around it. I cannot say with certainty where these experiences came from, but from inside them, they felt received. They carried an unmistakable sense of contact with something beyond the boundaries of my ordinary awareness. I am still searching. I still want the sound to return. The desire is no longer driven only by the hope of understanding what happened. I want to stand again inside a reality that large. I want another chance to encounter it without disappearing beneath the covers. I want to know whether I can listen without fear, deciding the limits of what I am able to hear. Maybe many of our practices begin there, with the knowledge that something once reached us, with a longing to become reachable again. I'm Lindsay. Thanks for spending some time in the space between. I'll see you in the next one. If this series has opened something for you, please consider sharing it. Independent work like this relies on listeners to sustain it. And if you'd like to support it directly, you can find a link in the show notes. Additional information about this series can be found at spacebetween.fm.